Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rise Radio Sinoland, on the D-Day beaches of Normandy in France. And I have a really wonderful guest on the show today, Felix Abt. How are you doing, Felix?
Thank you. I'm fine. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Yeah, Felix reached out to me. He sent me a show or an article about North Korea. I can't remember. I prefer DPRK for Democratic People's Republic of Korea, but anyway, DPRK. And he sent me a copy of his latest book about North Korea. And I read it. I was like, this is wonderful. So I contacted him and said, we got to get you on the show because very few people outside of North Korea have had his boots on the ground experiences. Let me just give you a quick introduction and we'll get started. Felix Abt is a serial entrepreneur. I like that. A serial entrepreneur and periodically a coach, trainer, and consultant. During his career, he has developed and managed a variety of businesses in different countries. He worked as a senior executive at multinational corporations such as the Swiss-Swedish ABB Group, a global leader in automation and power technologies. Also F. Hoffman La Roche Group, a global leader in healthcare, and the Zula Group, a leading Asian distribution and trading group. He also worked with smaller and medium-sized enterprises in both mature and new markets. And more pointedly today, he also feels privileged to have the opportunity to strengthen his experience as an investor and director of multiple companies. Thus far, he has lived and worked in 9 countries, including Vietnam, where he is now, and North Korea, which is what we're going to talk about today, on 3 different continents. So anyway, it's a real pleasure to have you on today, Felix. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Jeff.
Is there anything besides the short introduction that I sent? We're going to dive into North Korea, but would you like to tell us a little bit about, you know, where you come from and a little bit about you personally?
Yeah, okay. So in my 20s, early 20s, I felt attracted by other countries and other cultures, and I decided to work in companies which are export oriented and where I would have a chance of traveling and visiting countries and do business in different countries. And then also it opened me some opportunities to live in such countries for a shorter or longer period. And I always felt it very challenging and very interesting to learn from other people, not to go there and pass judgment or try to lecture them or to even liberate them, but to listen to them, to learn from them, yeah, and maybe develop something together with them. So I could, if you like, I could make my dream come true in a way. So I went to different countries. I saw how they developed. In the 80s, for the first time in China, I've seen how China had a breathtaking development, and then Vietnam later on, and then in the early 2000s, when I hear that North Korea is now interested in interacting with the outside world, wants to open up a little bit and do more trade with foreign companies, and when I was asked if I would go there to work for somebody else, I was delighted and I was happy to go there.
Absolutely incredible. Please just give us a look, because you know they don't call it the Hermit Kingdom for nothing, and you and I both know there's a lot of misinformation and anti-North Korean propaganda all across the West, what I call the big lie propaganda machine. So you've been there, you live there. Please give us the who, what, where, when, how, and why of your first time in North Korea and what happened and what happened from that point on?
So I went in 2002. I went to move to Pyongyang, and we had an office there. The Swiss-Swedish ABB group had an office there, and we started working on infrastructure projects. It was the DPRK government asked us to help improve, modernize, in particular the power supplies, power generation, power transmission, and supplies, but also to help modernize certain industries, for example, the cement industries, the steel industry, and so on. So these were the first assignments I had, and my pet project was really helping bring power to the people, power outside Pyongyang. Pyongyang is the capital, which is a little bit more privileged, has more has a better infrastructure, of course, than remote provinces. So our objective was to bring power to remote villages to help them lift from poverty. But later on, we got into trouble because, the U.S. government at the time did not want us to help the DPRK improve their infrastructure, and they were about to put more pressure on the DPRK to give up its self-defense projects, which was of course not acceptable to the DPRK, and but we got under pressure, under political pressure, not to continue these projects.
Well, that's sad. And you, how long did you live there?
I lived there for 7 years.
That's incredible. Did you learn the language some?
I took lessons. My wife also took Korean lessons, but I must say I was not a good student. My wife was excellent, but she's Vietnamese, and okay. And there's more affinity between Vietnamese and Korean than between my mother tongue, which is German, Korean. So and I was also, I mean, it's an excuse. I was very busy, so I was not studying hard enough.
Well, I know two other people who have gone there, but they did not live there for 7 years. Although I did report on the two Michaels, the two Canadian Michaels that were caught spying in North Korea and China, and that was, I wrote a great expose about that.
I know Michael Sperber, one of these two Michaels. He was caught in China. No, actually not in North Korea.
He
was in China, and that was at the time when there was when the CFO of Huawei was arrested in Canada, and well, some people would say it has something to do with that. It was a sort of a bargaining chip. I don't know. I cannot judge it.
Yeah.
But I Michael Sperber in North Korea, he was a guy who he had access to the supreme leader. He was not an apolitical person. I mean, I knew him. He did not talk about politics. He was a fun guy to be with. He also helped me doing a promotional video later when I was running a pharmaceutical factory. So I'm not sure about that. The other guy, I don't know. The other Canadian guy who was also arrested in China.
Yeah, Corvin.
But that was not that. I think it has nothing to do with North Korea, with the DPRK. It has something to do with with China.
So. Yeah. I'll send you my expose, and you can okay. See what I found out about. But anyway, two other people that I knew personally. Unfortunately, he died last year. Andre Vlechek. He went and spent some time there, and he, being a communist, was very accepted by the people he was working with, and so he got to travel quite a bit around the country and took videos and photographs and wrote a number of articles about his experiences in North Korea. And then the other one I don't know, although we've communicated by email, is Israel Shamir, and he went and spent time there and wrote a couple of just beautiful articles about North Korea. They were really, really heartfelt and full of a lot of empathy for North Korea. So, and Andre and Israel, you know, did not, you know, just said there's just a lot of propaganda and lies about North Korea. So how, you know, you talked about poverty in the north. I mean, compared to like eastern Oklahoma, where I'm from, where people live in trailer houses with plastic on the windows, and they're malnourished and undereducated and can't see a doctor and are sick and obese and their teeth are falling out. That's the kind of poverty I know back in the United States, all in a lot of cities and in a lot of rural areas all across the United States. When you say poverty in the North, I mean, what kind of poverty are we talking about?
Well, of course, I came across infrastructure that was broken down, for example, bridges that collapsed, there are sometimes storms and floods, and so these infrastructures are of course affected by natural calamities. But then also it's a question of resources. Sometimes the resources are not available to fix everything immediately. But I make a big difference between starvation and malnourishment. Malnourishment is not, people are not starving when they're malnourished. Maybe they don't have the proper diet all the time, or people may be slim, but I don't think during the time I lived there that there was any starvation. Of course, there was a time when the Soviet Union as main trading partner collapsed, and then there was natural calamities, and there was a famine which killed a certain number of people. But when I arrived in North Korea, I could not see anything anymore of this bad time. I mean, they had rebuilt a lot of things that were affected. And so it was on a good way. The country was on a good way, but it needed, of course, additional resources, and it needed some outside help as well to get faster out of this situation, and it was important also that they could sell their raw materials, export their raw materials to get hard currency, so they could import things, technology or whatever, and they wanted to do that. That was the intention. But then came more and more sanctions started blocking the trade, blocking imports and exports, and particularly in 2006, when there was the first nuclear test, that was taken as a pretext to impose heavy sanctions, mm-hmm. And then they even banned lipsticks, as called it a luxury product. So all women all over the world are allowed to use lipsticks. Only women in the DPRK would not be allowed to use lipsticks because this is a so-called luxury product. Imagine. So this is so, and then of course, yeah, everything was slowed down. They wanted to go faster, like China or Vietnam. They want to develop the economy, and but if you're isolated, they knew that if they're isolated, then it's difficult to develop fast enough. And also, they wanted to break away from what they called a culture of dependence, a dependency on humanitarian aid. They did not want to have food aid anymore and medicine from abroad and so on. What they wanted is to produce their own food, to produce their own medicine. But to produce food, you should be allowed to produce fertilizer. But when fertilizer imports are banned, because theoretically it could be used as a dual use product. It could be used for military purposes as well. Under this pretext, such things were also banned, and it had a negative impact on agriculture and food production. And so all these sanctions made is a huge stumbling block to the development of the country. It's a sad story, if you like.
Would you consider seeing the devastation that the many sanctions that the West has imposed upon North Korea, and what it has done to its economy and to its people, and you know, limiting the imports of, you know, drugs and raw materials to, you know, and as you said, fertilizer, food, et cetera. Do you consider the sanctions to be crimes against humanity?
I absolutely believe that sanctions kill. Sanctions are a weapon of hunger. You know, in a military war, you usually have a geographically limited area which you target. Whereas in sanctions, in embargoes, it affects everybody, the whole population, even beyond. You can see that now in the case of the conflict in the Ukraine, where the fertilizers, the European Union, for example, they have banned Russian fertilizer. And with this Russian fertilizer, that produces the food for hundreds of millions of people, in particular in poor countries. So if the fertilizer cannot be shipped to Africa, to Latin America, to South Asia, and so on, you will have millions of people that die of hunger. Because with this fertilizer, you produce grain, and with the grain, you produce bread and other products. So if you ban the fertilizer, you kill millions of people. Mm-hmm. And it's with all these sanctions, you for example, if now the pharmaceutical industry in the DPRK cannot keep up their standards that we have that were once reached in when I was there, the pharmaceutical industry reached international so-called GMP standard as defined by the World Health Organization. GMP means good manufacturing practices. Mm-hmm. And this standard could not be maintained after more sanctions were imposed, which means if you cannot have quality pharmaceutical at reasonable prices, locally made, then of course, lots of people will die because of an infection, even a simple infection, a little cut on your arm. If you don't disinfect it, it may become a big infection, a blood infection. You may die of it because you don't have the medicine. You don't have an antibiotic or just a disinfectant. And And that's the problem. And also in the food processing industry, you need, for example, you need certain reagents. You need a biological laboratory in a food processing factory, like in a pharmaceutical factory. And there you need so-called reagents. These are chemicals to identify, to detect germs that can make people sick. And of course, you cannot allow these germs, bacteria, viruses, parasites, and so go into the food or go into your medicine that you give to the people. So this is something standard everywhere in the world, in the US, in Europe, everywhere. Pharmaceutical factories and food processing factories can have a biological lab and do their tests. The DPRK is the only country where it's not allowed. Imagine.
I think it's war crimes. I mean, I think it's genocide. It's not just North Korea. You know, Venezuela is going through a similar situation. They did a study, and it wasn't even Venezuela that did it. It was a neutral organization. I can't remember which one it was, who said that in the 2 year period that they studied Venezuela, that 19,000 people died because of America's sanctions and the West, because you're German, I'm half French, I live in France, and Europe's right there, right behind the United States, to back them up. And Cuba, which has been under the worst possible sanctions since 1959, with the liberation of Cuba by Fidel Castro, and so they are all of these sanctions. And if people go to the ministry of not the ministry the wrong country the Department of Commerce and the Department of Justice websites in the United States, it's not just Korea and Cuba and Venezuela. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of these sanctions, sometimes against one person, sometimes against a company, sometimes against an entire country, blockades, and they are killing people. They are literally war. The United States and Europe are declaring war on these countries without having to fire a bullet, and they're killing over time millions of people. Let me just look at Syria, anyway, it's sad and it's pathetic what can I say? Let me ask you another question. China and Russia both have borders. China's is quite large. Russia only has about 12 or 15 kilometers of common border with North Korea, but China's got, the Yalu River. And I know there's a lot of informal trade going across the Yalu River. In fact, there's a million and a half or 2 million North Koreans living in China doing commerce across the Yalu River. For consumer goods and that kind of stuff. But what about, China and Russia, unfortunately, regretfully agreed to the sanctions. What was it, 2006 or 2007? I can't remember.
2006
and 2007. And I think they really, really regret it now. They're now trying to get the United States to lift them. And of course, the United States will not, because they want to destroy North Korea as it is today, and if they kill millions of people, the United States doesn't care. But there are there's bridges and trains and a number of railroad tracks, going across from China. During all of this sanction period up to today, how much big movement of like coal or grain or livestock? Do you think at that level the Chinese were helping out North Korea to overcome the sanctions at the big commercial level?
Well, as you said, in 2006, after this nuclear test, there were several rounds of sanctions, and both China and Russia, they have agreed to also apply these sanctions. And then if you look at the trade statistics from then on, the trade with China really decreased substantially over the 4 years. Of course, there may be some informal trade because the border is, as you said, is very, very large and porous. So there is some informal trade which may not be reflected in the trade statistics. But for example, the sanctions, the so-called United Nations Security Council sanctions, prohibited the export of coal. And the city of Shanghai was one of the biggest buyer of DPRK coal. To a large extent, it has been heated by DPRK coal. So it was from one day to the next, Shanghai had to look for other suppliers. And so the same was with many other. North Korea is rich in minerals, metals, yeah, and other raw materials. And with these exports, they paid, for example, for the food which they could not produce themselves. So they imported the food, they imported technology, machinery, and so on. And if you have no export, you cannot afford anymore. You cannot pay for any more imports, so you stand still. You have to get along with what you have, but it's very hard to move on with that little that you have.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You told me, of course, and we'll get to your books here next. But you know, you told me that you've got personally invested in several companies in North Korea to help the people with pharmaceuticals and other useful consumer goods. And as you said, you were trying to bring electricity further out into the countryside, and that was all destroyed by these sanctions. It's demoralizing, to see this. I think people need, for people who don't know about Korea, the north is very rugged and mountainous, and has apparently several trillion dollars worth of mineral resources that are proven resources. It's incredibly the earth is very rich up there for minerals. All the good land for agriculture is in the south, in the southern part of the country where the South Korea is. So food is an issue there. And well, maybe I don't know. I just don't understand why China doesn't say, to heck with the sanctions and just starts, just letting the Koreans, do swaps with coal and food and, because China's got, grain reserves they could, provide, to do even swaps, without even any money. But we'll have to see what happens with that. Well, tell us about, you have written two books about the DPRK. The first one was, quote, A Capitalist in North Korea. I like that. My 7 years in the Hermit Kingdom. And then I read your latest one, which is, quote, A Land of Prison Camps, Starving Slaves, and Nuclear Bombs, An Alternative Account to the Western Media's Blinkered North Korea Portrayal. Obviously, you felt inspired to write these books. Tell us a little bit about your two books and how they relate to each other and when you wrote them, et cetera.
Yeah, okay. I'm just a businessman. I never thought that I would ever write a book because I'm not a good speaker. I'm not a good writer. I'm perhaps better as a businessman doing business and trading and setting up a factory. But I was really I felt so provoked and outraged by the Western media reporting, with all their stereotypes and lies and this manipulative reporting, that I really felt compelled. And also I felt I should do something for my North Korean friends and business partners and my co-workers and suppliers with whom I had a good relationship, and to tell what I have seen with my own eyes, what I have experienced for 7 years, to give another perspective, to tell how it was, how I experienced it. And I did not write a book to make money. I did not make money with these books anyway. So, and interestingly, I at the beginning, my first book, nobody wanted to publish it. So I had to. I became a self-publisher on Kindle, Amazon. You know,
yeah.
And only when they saw a publisher saw that it sold, not big, but it sold to a certain extent, then they sent me a contract and said, okay, we can do we can publish it for you. all this, you know, that you're a book author yourself.
Yeah.
You have to go through these gatekeepers called literary agents.
Yeah.
And there were one or two literary agents told me, Felix, why are you so serious and so honest and so on like that? You cannot sell your book. You have to add more spice and exaggerate a little bit. And nobody is really, no author is totally honest and so on. And why don't you, all the North Korea books that sell well, they write about brutality and prison camps and starving people and so on. Why don't you write about your employees that suddenly disappeared the next day, that they didn't come back to work because they were sent to a gulag? And then I said, hey, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to tell nonsense and lies just to sell a book. I write a book to tell my true story, not to make things even worse and add to the same propaganda. No, I would rather prefer not to write the book at all than lying in my books. And that's why then they say, well, in this case, you will not sell much or you will sell nothing. And I said, even if I sell very little, at least I have done my moral duty. I have told the world the truth. Those who want to hear it, I told them the truth, not propaganda.
I used to, there's a very good writer about Russia named Dr. Grover Fur, and he's a professor at a college in the United States. And the only reason he hasn't been fired is because his subject matter at the university is not Russia in the USSR, but ancient languages or something. So they can't fire him. But he's written a number of books about the Stalin period, and just debunking all the lies. He speaks and reads and writes fluent Russian, debunking all the lies and the propaganda and just the grotesque, you know, exaggerations and et cetera. And as he likes to joke, is that you cannot get published in the West, if you write a book about the USSR and Stalin that does not demonize both the country and the person. You have to write about how awful, you know, and brutal and genocidal they are. Otherwise, you'll never get a book contract. And it's the same thing.
That is exactly what happened to me.
Exactly. So he gets published by a small publishing company. And it's the same thing with China. You cannot get a book published about China if you say anything nice about the Mao era or Mao Zedong or the Communist Party of China. You have to portray Mao Zedong, you know, that he has vampire fangs and claws and green moss between his teeth, and how he wakes up every day and has lists of thousands of people to slaughter, and otherwise you won't get published, you know? It's just the most grotesque propaganda. So I'm self-published my China trilogy. Like you, I published two of them on Amazon. And then the second one is published by, Punto Press, but we're friends, but it's also on Amazon, because otherwise you're not going to get books published if you write the truth about the West's many, many enemies around the world. So, well, I think this has just been incredible. What you're telling me is, you know, Andrei Vlechek and Israel Shamir, and I'll try to find those two articles for you by Israel. They were so beautiful and so touching. But they both said the Koreans are happy. They just want to be left alone. They like their culture. They like their history. And, you know, it's actually probably maybe even more Buddhist than China. You know, Korea is very, very Buddhist. North Korea, I've read, is very, very Buddhist. And they're very happy. And in spite of all the hardships out, you know, in the countryside, and they're very proud, and they don't have 250,000 prostitutes, having sex with 30,000, American soldiers, like happens in South Korea, and they're not occupied by the military with dozens of military bases, and they're independent. So I'm sure that you had some similar feelings. Do you have any reflections about that, about the happiness of the people and their attitude and et cetera? Do you want to comment on that?
Well, yeah, it's true. They're certainly proud people. They are conscious of their history, their culture, Confucianism. I mean, yeah. For example, learning is very important for them. Studying seriously is important. And I mean, with all the staff and with customers and suppliers, I had a good relationship. I found them very normal people, and they had their joys and they had their sorrows. Some mothers told me, I'm not sure if my child can passes the exam to enter the university. I worry about that. So when the child passed the entrance exam, she brought a big cake to the office, and we celebrated that all together. You know, so it was very human and very humane, and we went out. We worked hard, but we also partied hard. We went out to have karaoke, sing together, or made excursions into the countryside, and we did sport together, and it was a good time. At least those who work, those with whom I worked, they were ordinary people and were happy with their lives and did not complain. At least not to me.
Yeah. It's he wants to remain anonymous, of course, because in South Korea, if you say anything good about North Korea, you can go to jail. There are actually people in South Korea who are in jail today for using Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or whatever to say something nice about North Korea. There are people actually in South Korea who have been jailed for that. So
yeah,
this,
they still have this national security law, which is very strict, and
So anyway, he emailed me, and I asked him. I'd love to get you on the show. Of course, he doesn't want to identify himself, so he gave me written answers to some questions I had for him, and I'm gonna publish it later this week. And he commented, you know, that he really respects, you know, the North Koreans. They're proud. They you know, they're proud of their culture. They're proud, you know, again, they're proud of their history. And he, you know, said, you know, that's something that the South has lost with the, you know, the Americanization of the culture and the Americanization of the economy. And I think he feels a little bit envious of how Korean the North Koreans are.
And yeah, that's true. That's more, they're more authentic Koreans that are in the North. So, yeah. And it's true. And they're also proud of that, of this. They feel they're the guardians of this Koreanness.
Well, they are.
Korean culture.
I'd love to go. It's supposed to be even more, well, South Korea is a spectacularly beautiful country. It's really a beautiful country. I've been there and traveled around. Of course, I've not been to North Korea, but I've heard it's even maybe even more beautiful just because of all the mountains and valleys, and it's such a rugged, you know, such a rugged terrain. It's supposed to be really spectacular.
Yeah, it's really worthwhile going there. But you, as an American, you are not allowed. Your government does not allow you to go there.
I have a French passport. I'm half French.
Okay. All right. Good.
So I could go on my French passport.
But
I do know they have tourism there, but it's quite expensive. Yeah, sure. It's quite expensive, and of course now with COVID, the COVID madness and everything else, it's kind of hard to. It makes travel very, very difficult. So, well, listen, this has been wonderful. I have seen you. You've written a couple of articles for Covert Action Magazine. Is that what you're going to be doing now? Is just doing some occasional article writing, or are you going to do anything? Are you going to try to write another book, or stick writing maybe some articles for Covert Action Magazine?
No, I'm only writing occasionally articles. I'm not a writer. I'm more like, you know, I'm more involved in doing some business, but I'm not a good writer anyway.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Your article on Covert Action Magazine was I've read two or three, I think, and they're quite good, especially since English is not your mother tongue. It's quite impressive. So I think your English is probably better than me writing in French. So my French writing is okay, but it's not Rousseau or Voltaire, that's for sure. Well, listen, I will include the links to his two books on Amazon. They're not long. They're fun books. They're fast paced and they're not expensive. So I would encourage everybody out there to get a boots on the ground, real live experience about what's going on in North Korea. I have those. I also have his Twitter account, and he also has a LinkedIn account, and so I will include those. And anyway, thank you so much, Phoebe, for being on. It's just been a blast, and good luck in Nha Trang and Vietnam, and maybe one of these days our paths will cross somewhere there in Asia or here in Europe if you come back home.
Yeah, we'll be happy to meet you in person, and thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure for me.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, since we both have lived and worked in Asia for years, I'll give you a Buddhist bath.
Okay.
Right. Take care. I'll let you know when this goes up, and maybe you can share it in your circles.
I will do that, yeah. Thank you very much. Bye-bye, Chad. Bye.